inspector was involved with it and was a user out there, so I knew what was going on, but I didn't pay a lot of attention to it.
What year was this?
Would have been between 64 and 68.
Okay.
So that's maybe a good place to start. I was a grad student in physics, studying under Richard N. Dexter from 1964 to 1968. And that's about the time Tantalus got established as a user facility light source.
Mm-hmm. And what did you study?
I didn't use the light source at all. I studied, let's see, do you really want the title?
Yeah, absolutely.
Helicon propagation in mercury cadmium telluride.
I asked for it.
It was, helicons are plasma waves. Mercury cadmium telluride is a semiconductor. It's a solid solution or mixture of mercury telluride and cadmium telluride. And the interesting thing about it is it has a very small energy band gap that's adjustable by adjusting the amount of the ratio of cadmium to mercury. And when electrons move through semiconductors, they behave as if they have a mass that's different from the mass they have if they're in air or in vacuum or in free space. And that's called the effective mass. And what I worked on was a method that enabled me to measure the effective mass of electrons in mercury cadmium telluride. And I think maybe to this very day, I hold a world record for the smallest electron effective mass ever measured. Electrons behave as if they're very, very light when they're moving through this, through this stuff. And the work was sponsored by the Air Force because narrow band gap semiconductors are good for infrared detectors. And okay. We wanted infrared detectors for, I don't know what, probably missile guidance or torpedo guidance or heat-seeking devices of all kinds. And right now, some of the best infrared detectors and night vision goggles and things like that do use mercury cadmium telluride detectors.
Has there been any research since then? Big research?
Probably, but not much. I changed areas completely after I left here. I worked at Bell Telephone Labs, worked on some of the first red light emitting diodes when they were just laboratory curiosities, and microwave transistors and magnetic bubble memory chips and things like that.
So you only worked around the Tantalus facility from 64 to 68?
Well, then I came back on the faculty in 75.
Okay.
And during my time in the faculty in electrical engineering here, I got involved in some work that did take me back to SRC. And that was something called X-ray lithography. Mm-hmm. Working with Jim Taylor in the chemistry department. Jim will know a lot of the history of Tantalus and Aladdin. And also with Franco Serena in electrical engineering. He's now off at Boston University, but he'll be back in the first week of July if you wanted to talk to him. Okay. I could give you his email address.
Yeah, actually.
He was the director of the Center for X-ray Lithography, and I did some work there. My wife also worked out there at SRC. Actually, she worked for the Center for X-ray Lithography as a technical writer. So, actually, I had a lot more to do with SRC when I was here on the faculty than I did when I was a student.
Okay. And at the time, what was the administration like during the 1975 era?
Which administration?
Just the SRC in general. What was the state of it?
Oh, well, I thought it was always a very well-run facility. Ed Rowe is the real giant of this whole story. He was never a faculty member. He had a sort of a courtesy appointment or a adjunct appointment in what was then called the Department of Nuclear Engineering. It's now Engineering Physics. But that was, he had an affiliation with that department, and I think he taught some courses on accelerator design. But he was technically an academic staff member, not a faculty member, and he was the director during a lot of its early years. I thought it was well run in the sense that Ed and his team just had golden hands. They could just make things work. And they also knew how to cater to the needs of the researchers. So it always had a reputation as being a very user-friendly place to do your work, to get your work done. They would bend over backwards to help you do whatever you needed to do.
Great. And then how long did you stay with the SRC?
Well, until I became dean of the graduate school, which is a full-time administrative job. And at that time, SRC then reported to me because it's a grad school center. And so, let's see, the first director when I was dean, I believe, was either Keith Simon or Dave Huber.
I think I had a
record. You have a complete list of directors?
Yeah, somewhere around here. Here we go. 1975.
And this would be well, about 89.
That would have been Dave Huber.
Dave Huber, yeah. And so I had oversight responsibility for SRC for the next 5 years while I was dean of the grad school. And I met with them fairly frequently and attended all their site visits and helped them in whatever way I could with budget or other issues, personnel issues, that kind of stuff.
Great. Well, maybe we can move on to that kind of area of administration and funding and those kind of issues. And a few questions here. Maybe you could tell me about some of the things that were tricky regarding funding and things like facilities that are tied to a university.
Yeah. Well, you'll hear from a lot of researchers that NSF doesn't really stand for National Science Foundation. It stands for not sufficient funding. They have a habit of underfunding almost every project they support. They try to stretch their money and get as many grants as they can by cutting them all down to less than what's needed to do a really good job, which is a chronic problem. And then they expect the institutions, the universities, to somehow bridge the gap. Mm-hmm. So we are under constant pressure to provide more university funds to places like the SRC. And we do the best we can, but in the end, you know, there are only 5 sources of money for any university. One is the state for state schools. Another is the feds. But federal money is almost entirely targeted grants. You can't reallocate from one grant to another. So those are both off limits. Or that one's off limits. Gifts from alumni are also almost always targeted. If you imagine yourself a wealthy alum and you want to give some money to your university, you probably have an idea what you want to support. It'll be a scholarship for students, or it'll be a named chair for a distinguished professor, or it'll be a building. But you won't just say, here, Chancellor, here's $1 million, do whatever you want with it, right? So we can't use gift money much for things like that. And there's program revenue. That's money you get for selling things like football tickets. But I can't sell football tickets and then take that money and say, we're going to cancel the game and spend it instead on SRC. Mm-hmm. So that's about it. The other's tuition, student tuition. And it's, I don't think students would be too happy if they knew that part of their tuition was supporting a research facility that has nothing to do with their instruction and their education. So there are really limited opportunities to provide university money into a place like SRC. And that was always a struggle. And it still is to this day. Now, NIH and some other federal agencies understand that and deal with it better than the NSF does.
The NIH is?
National Institutes of Health.
Okay.
They provide most of the funding in the life sciences, biology and medicine and so on.
Okay.
But NSF is best when it's funding single investigator research at modest levels, and they're at their worst when they're funding large equipment programs like SRC. Mm-hmm. They just never have quite figured out how to do it in a way that makes sense.
That's a pattern that I've heard from a lot of them. In one of the proposals, I think it was Jim Taylor showed me this. Thank you. 2001 proposal, they compared the budgets to papers written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it shows that SRC is one of the most productive facilities in the world in terms of output for dollar of input. And let's see, ALS, APS, NSLS, all those others are supported by the Department of Energy, not the NSF. Mm-hmm. And you can see they're supported at much more generous levels. Now, they're bigger machines, too, so part of that is just the size. Mm-hmm. But I think to this very day, Tantalus and then Aladdin are by far the cheapest or most cost-effective light sources ever built anywhere in the world. And that's a credit to the ingenuity of Ed Rowe and his team. Ed was involved in building both of those. And here's a story you may not have gotten from anyone else. I don't know. You can stop me if you did. But I do remember during the construction phase of Aladdin, the NSF was constantly pressing us to economize in all sorts of ways. And one of Ed's great ideas was, first of all, the reason that's out there in Stoughton, or in Dunn, the town of Dunn, mm-hmm. is because there's a very large, thick, flat sheet of bedrock not very far below the surface. It's a really solid mm-hmm. area, and this is not a particularly earthquake-prone area, so it provides a tremendously stable platform to build something like this on, very vibration-free. And it's important because if you're sending a beam of electrons around in a 70-foot diameter circle or square, any little motion or vibration can throw it off track. And the alignment is very critical to a high degree of precision. So one of Ed's brilliant ideas was we can save money when we're pouring the footings, the concrete footings, by simply pouring raw concrete down for the floor. Not any water mixed with it. Just concrete dust. Because over the years, moisture will seep into it and it will harden and it'll be firm enough. I mean, a good thick layer of wet concrete was put on top of it, but that was the base underneath mm-hmm. the floor. And I can't remember how thick it was, but I know the poured concrete was about 9 inches thick on top of a big bed of concrete powder. And that saved a lot of money by not having to mix and pour wet concrete for such a huge area. Have you been out and seen the machine?
Yeah.
So you know that's a huge floor.
Yeah.
So that was one of the steps that was done to economize. NSF loved the idea. They approved it. They thought it was very creative and ingenious. And that enabled them to cut our budget by, I don't remember, several hundred thousand dollars to save that money. Then time went on. There were some other economies that I won't go into, other things that we did. Oh, I know. One of them was we decided we would not need to put in what are called clearing electrodes. Mm-hmm. And that saved some money. So the machine was finally done and turned on, and it didn't work up to specifications. And NSF got really angry about that and said they were going to pull the plug if we didn't get it fixed, and criticized us for not putting down an adequate floor and for not putting in clearing electrodes.
Oh boy.
And in fact, they made the chancellor, who at that time was Irving Shane, become the principal investigator. They removed Ed as principal investigator. Made the chancellor personally take on that job, to take personal responsibility for getting all the problems fixed. They did pull the financial plug for, I think it was 1 year, mm-hmm. just completely cut off our money, and Worf came up with about $1 million to bridge the gap at the chancellor's request. He went to Worf and asked them for that money, and they gave it to him. And as it turned out, it was nothing about the floor that caused the problems. It was the lack of clearing electrodes. Yeah. And when those were put in, bingo, the thing worked great. Mm-hmm. So Ed hadn't done anything wrong, really, except maybe agreeing to leave out the clearing electrodes. Do you know what those are?
Yeah.
Okay. And NSF was suddenly happy again because the machine was working and users were happy. And for the next 10 or 15 years, it just hummed along, getting a lot of productive work done.
I'm wondering what your opinion is about the NSF. Is a lot of the interviews I've done, they've said that NSF always had very starry-eyed dreams that Tantalus or Aladdin would be running at 1 amp, whereas the highest energy that they've ever, they've ever reached was 280 milliamps.
Yeah. Yeah, there, I don't think there was any machine designer, certainly not Ed or Keith Simon, a physics professor, or I'm forgetting the names of some of the other theorists who worked on the design. I don't think any of them believed that it would realistically get to an amp. That was a starry-eyed dream, but it wasn't an expectation.
That brings me to another question. What do you think about the local knowledge about the SRC being so far from campus? Before I started this project, I never heard of it either, and I'd been here for 3 years, so do you think that being out in Stoughton really affects the way it...
Oh, to some extent, but I could probably name lots of facilities on campus that you also haven't heard of that have big national or world reputations. So I don't think that's a huge deal. I know a lot of people think it is, but I've never really agreed with that. I didn't find it particularly inconvenient to drive out there. It's only 13 miles. Mm-hmm. It's a pleasant drive. Certainly the people in the neighborhood out there know about it. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the town of Dunn and everyone in Stoughton. They have an annual open house for the public and invite their neighbors in to see what's going on so that they're not afraid because the word radiation is in the title and that sort of thing. It's always true that your reputation is greater away from campus than on campus. It's such a big place, there's so much going on. Almost nobody knows everything that's going on. For example, we've got an art press out on Dickinson Street on the Near East Side. That's maybe 3 miles from campus. And I would venture to say that most people on campus don't even know it's there. It's known in the art world as the best art press in the country. And they get invited to art shows all over the world. Switzerland, there's a big one annually in Florida, another one in New York, another one in Los Angeles. They're always there represented. But around here, you can count on, a few hundred people even know about it. That's it.
And you feel the same way about the state as a whole, knowing about the SRC?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't know that there's anything wrong with that. It's, like I said, there's a lot going on, and there's a lot of things most people don't know about. People move to Madison just to live near the Weissman Center if they have a child with Down syndrome. They're world famous in childhood developmental disabilities, and they specialize in Down syndrome, among other things. But there are lots of families who heard about it from California or from Canada or wherever and decided they would move here just to be close to that service. So in some specialized communities, they're very, very famous. There are, I think, only 8 or 9 centers like that in the whole country, and we have one of them. We have a primate center for research on monkeys. There are only, I think, 7 or 8 of those in the country. We have one of those. We have one of almost everything. And for a long time, we had the only academic user facility for synchrotron radiation. And by the way, Tantalus, an exact copy of Tantalus is still alive and well and working at the what used to be called the National Bureau of Standards. It's now the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST.
Washington, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's technically in Bethesda or somewhere near in the Washington area. And shortly after Tantalus was up and running, NIST asked us to make them one.
Yep.
So we built one for them and shipped it to them. And the original Tantalus that was here has been dismantled, and I think most of its parts are probably discarded, but the body of it is at Smithsonian.
Yeah.
someday it'll be in a display, I guess.
Someday. They just got the letter now that they received it.
And oh, really?
They're going to someday
my
put it
God,
on.
That took years.
It's only been 12 years.
Yeah.
All right, maybe one more question. What about the administrative and political issues that play a role in facilities' fate and their funding?
Well, they do play a role. I haven't been real close to this because I've been out of administrative jobs for many months now, and this stuff moves fast. But while I was chancellor, we hired a professor from MIT to help us design the next Aladdin. It would be a free electron laser light source, and it's huge and expensive. We told NSF what we were doing. They encouraged us to do that planning. We did some checking and calling around and found that if MIT and Wisconsin collaborate on this, we would probably be the only group in the country able and willing to try to do it, to make one of these. But there's also a light source at Cornell, and they got wind of what we were doing and also put in a proposal to do something not the same but similar enough. And I think in recent months, the whole question of whether or not the NSF will fund a next generation light source, and if so, where it will be, has become very political. And I, as far as I can tell, a decision, and I don't know if it's a final decision, but a decision has been made that they will give Cornell the money to take the next step in planning, but not us. So it looks like it's leaning toward Cornell, which is why I'm a little pessimistic about the future of SRC. I think Aladdin realistically has reached the end of its useful life. It can do more of the same, but not new and different things. And it's expensive to run. I think the NSF will pull a plug on it. And if we don't have something else in the pipeline, it'll just sit there as a white elephant.
Mm-hmm.
And I would bet that that's what's going to happen.
Heard from Joe, the director now, he had told me about that the DOE is the ones who fund the really large projects, mm-hmm. and the NSF likes to stay a little bit smaller scale, so that the very fact that the SRC is bumping their heads into the really big scale was kind of shaky for them.
Now, NSF has funded some really big scale stuff, including here. We have a roughly $250 million project for the NSF. That plaque on the wall, Ice Cube,
yeah.
We're building that down at the South Pole.
Mm-hmm.
That's a 10-year, $250 million project. It's way more expensive than SRC. It's $25 million a year for 10 years instead of $4 million a year. So they do occasionally do really big projects. The real acid test for Ice Cube will come after it's done, after the construction phase is over, and we negotiate with the NSF an operating budget to keep it running into the future. That's where they get really cheap on you.
So that kind of explains the same situation for the SRC.
Yeah.
And would that be similar for an FEL?
Probably. Almost certainly. Yeah.
It's ironic.
And another big NSF project is called LIGO, the Long Interferometric. I can't remember what it stands for. It's a gravity wave detector.
Mm.
Lasers shining over miles and miles to detect gravity waves, which no one's ever unambiguously detected. And that was also a very big multi-$100 million undertaking that they did, but they don't do it very often.
What about the PSL? What is the graduate school's relationship with that?
It reports to the grad school, and it's basically a really, really high-tech, high-capability design and construction shop, machine shop. They have some of the very best welders in the world who can just weld anything, including metals that nobody else would dare mess with, like magnesium and beryllium and titanium, things that can spontaneously combust just when you're grinding them in a milling machine or a lathe, or things that produce toxic fumes or toxic dust. But they're brilliant at that. They also have electronics technicians that can design electronic circuit boards and modules, package it all together. They make all of the parts for Ice Cube. Mm-hmm. They design and built the drill that drills a mile deep hole in ice using steam. Mm-hmm. The steam comes from two car wash machines. That's how they generate the hot water and steam to drill these holes. Again, it's an example of very clever, economical construction of a big, otherwise expensive thing. I mean, the DOE doesn't mess around with that. If you told DOE to make a drill that would drill a mile deep hole in the ice, their first thought would be, how expensive can we make it? We want this to be a big, expensive project to keep a lot of people employed.
Where's the funding base for DOE?
Well, it's a cabinet-level department, the Department of Energy, and it gets put in the president's budget. NSF is not a cabinet-level department. So their money, the president does put money in for the NSF in his budget, but I think Congress is a lot more influential in determining the budget of NSF than it is in determining the budget of DOE. And DOE is so big. They've got all the weapons programs, all the nuclear weapons, lots of other stuff. And so their budget is huge, and that means even if a tiny fraction of it goes into their laboratories and science projects, it's almost not noticeable in the scale of the whole budget. So they can get away with being wasteful.
Well, that's all of the questions I have now. Is there anything else you'd like to say about funding or SRC as a whole?
Oh, well, I have lots of fun memories of things that have gone on out there. It was always a very collegial, fun place to work. Always something exciting going on. It'll be sad to see it close down, but as I said before, I think that's the handwriting's on the wall that's going to happen. And then I don't know what the university will do with it, and I don't know what impact that'll have on PSL. I mean, PSL has limited ability to compete with the private sector and take on jobs from outside the university. So they rely on a steady stream of business from within the university, and they charge for their services. I imagine the loss of SRC will cause PSL to downsize pretty substantially and may eventually threaten their viability.
You don't think the PSL has built up a reputation?
Oh, they have. Yeah, a very good one. But they need a steady stream of large business. They've had a lot of business from Ice Cube, but that'll be done in another couple of years, and that business stream will go away. If SRC goes away, they lose that business stream. Mm-hmm. You can't afford to lose too many of your big customers and still stay in business. So I think what they're hoping is that something else will come along, and the free electron laser would have been one of those. Mm-hmm. But you know what? These days I can think about these things and say, well, that's somebody else's problem now.
Great.